Your New York weekend is not complete without the Joan Hamburg Show on 77 WABC.
Yes, you're at the right place. You are at the Joan Hamburg Show, and welcome to you. We are going to start in just a bit. We've got great guests, one of my favorite foodies, the television personality, the cookbook author, the travel authority, Lydia Bastianich, is going to take us across America and share her adventures, holidays in little towns, all across our great country, what people are doing and thinking. We've got a lot of wonderful guests, and I want you to be part of it. And I want to share my week. Saw a great Broadway show that I really enjoyed, a one-man show, Mike Birbiglia's The New One on Broadway. He's a comic, and it's interesting. A lot of people of my generation aren't familiar with him, where I work in a world of young people, and they all worship him. So my daughter and I went to see him at a matinee. It was great. Oh, he's so smart. We had such a good time. I'm going to try to get him on the air for all of you. A really superb performer, writer, and what a life. Mike Birbiglia at the Court Theater on Broadway. And people are already asking me, Christmas, Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, what am I going to do? Well, you know, for years, our family celebrated the holidays with friends. We always had friends from Italy join us. And, of course, they wanted to go to Mass later on. So we would aim for one of our favorite places, Fresco by Scotto on 34 East 52nd Street. They have a Christmas Eve special, 7 Fish, 212-935-3434. They have music and carolers. My husband always sang Christmas carols there. And you get the 7 Fish with shared appetizers. And you have a choice of Price Fricks dinner. If you don't like fish, like the man I'm married to is allergic, you can get anything else you want. Very good place. And the Lambs Club, that's another fabulous place. And they're doing Christmas carols. Their price is very reasonable, 132 West 44th Street, great location, right near the tree. They're doing a brunch on Saturday the 22nd. They're doing Christmas Eve and Christmas Day from 11 to 3, starting at around $68 a person, kids much less. So mark this special, 212-997-5262. Chinese restaurants, of course, Red Farm. It's expensive, but it's fabulous. One at 529 Hudson Street, one at 2170 Broadway, and Christmas Eve they're opening at 445. And, of course, our favorite, Namwa, always there, reasonable, terrific. Two branches, one in Chinatown, another one downtown, too. But I've got to make room for the great Joan Hamburg Show straight ahead. Stay tuned.
From food to fun and so much more, The Joan Hamburg Show, exclusively on 77 WABC.
You know, this time of year is really special. When I was a kid growing up, I used to read, I think it was in Ladies' Home Journal, How America Lives. I just, even as a kid, loved that. Loved going to small towns and via print. And Lydia has taken this steps further. Lydia Bastianich, who's an Emmy Award-winning television host, a best-selling cookbook author, restaurants galore, a flourishing food and entertainment business. And for this holiday, she traveled all over small town America to learn food traditions and celebrations. And it's something that you can all see. It's going to premiere on the 18th, and you can just check PBS for all the holiday times. So what gave you this thought, and how did you pick where to go, Lydia?
Well, you know, I've been doing a special for PBS, a Christmas special, already 7 years. And what I love about it is visiting and exploring America. Now, you know, I am an immigrant, and now ever more that immigrant subject is out there. But, you know, America, as you travel through, yes, it's a big kind of American feel and strength. But within that, you find all these pockets of ethnicity and how America is really made of this immigrants story from way back, you know, whether it's the Italians, whether it's the Irish, whether it's the Jewish, whether it's two generations, whether it's four generations, you know, these are the people that ultimately made America and continue to make it. And you know what? As you travel through small town America, you know, where really America's heartbeat is, you still find the tradition in this two, second, third, fourth generation of cultures that still some of that original culture tradition exists, especially on the holidays, in the food.
Right, and I found it so interesting. I've known you since you had a little restaurant in Queens, and who knew that you went to high school in Sunbury, Pennsylvania?
Did you see? Did you see
how that? Did you land there?
Well, you see, after we came here as immigrants, and we were brought here, you know, by the Red Cross, Catholic Charities, we had nobody. Ultimately, we found that there was a distant cousin. My mother's mother, sister, had landed in Pennsylvania because there it was the, in Shamokin, there were, which is close to Sunbury, they were the mines. And that's where they got the job. And we found that we had a family there. And you know what? In the first year as a young immigrant here, I was lonely. I missed grandma. I missed the countryside.
Of course, your life.
Exactly. And so the second year of my schooling here, my mother says, why don't you go and stay with our relatives in Pennsylvania? It'll bring you closer to what you missed, the grandma kind of countryside that you missed. And it did. And I spent the whole year there and I loved it. And I really got to be American, you know, because in a small town, you know, you become American, you know, and I felt American more than ever,
right,
in Sunbury.
Were you accepted?
I was. You know, I was almost a curiosity.
Right, because
they didn't know somebody that spoke different languages. They didn't know somebody that had an accent, a young girl especially. And they wanted to know my story and how I traveled and how finally, you know, because ours is a story. It's of refugee and refugee camp for 2 years. And they were curious. So I was kind of a curiosity for the press, for the school, for everybody.
Right.
And I loved the attention. I loved that I had something to tell to this country that sort of accepted me. You know, the country that kind of gave me an opportunity. Now I was given something back.
That's for sure. And of course, in that part of Pennsylvania, there's Pennsylvania Dutch, which is, if you've never been to our audience, it's quite spectacular. It's like being in a foreign country in America.
It is. It is. You know, there's the Pennsylvania Dutch, it's the Amish, and they have their own little thing. But also the people around there mostly are of Dutch and German origin. And within their customs for the holidays, they still make, you know, their dessert especially and food from their tradition. So much so, you know, the thing that interests me, some of the foods that were really I was curious about was shoofly pie,
Yeah. Succotash,
all of these things I had never had. I think succotash was more really national and Indian kind of the native. But shoofly pie, that was Dutch. And I went there this in the family, and she taught me really how to make shoofly pie. And it's really interesting. They still, and I think this family was third or fourth generation German, they still speak a dialect which has a little bit of German in it. It's amazing.
There's so many fabulous places. But again, with everything, how did you pick Louisiana in a little town there?
Well, you know Louisiana because it's sort of a teamwork. My team, my production team, the GBH, the public station in Boston, which collaborates with this, we got all together and said, you know, what is the message that we want to say? Me, I was always curious about Louisiana and the culture there called
Creole
culture. I was always curious about this Creole culture. Is it French? Is it Spanish? Is it African? And it's all of those. It was amazing. And even the people that I met, that I spoke to, that ultimately, you know, kind of taught me how to make gumbo. You know, they're mixed.
Down home.
And they told me their stories, which was wonderful. So now I have a real good sense of what Louisiana, you know, the, how America was occupied ultimately, in a sense, how was, all the immigrants came and settled in different parts of America.
And it's food that really holds people together. And it was interesting to find out that in this country, we forget, three-quarters of the land is rural, and over 50 million Americans live in these little towns and live in or around farmlands, whether they're new arrivals or whether they've been there for generations.
Absolutely. You know what? I really was amazing. I went down to Texas, and Texas, we went to a fair, a Dalton Fair, I think it was. And there, I met this wonderful Mexican family, this Mexican young man, with tamales, how they really made their family live well and prosperous, and how they were accepted into the Texas kind of lifestyle. But what was amazing also, I met this young Kate, this young 12-year-old who had five little pigs, and they were big, never mind little. And how she would enter
in the fair.
In the fair. And how she took care of these animals and brushed them and shampooed them and cut their hairs and their their hoofs and everything. And I, you know, we really spent some time because I thought, you know, when I was young, I worked with Grandma, and she had her little farm, and we had pigs. We had two pigs. We had, you know, ultimately they became food for us.
Right.
But it was amazing how this you know, how
kid.
Young people across in rural America still respect the land and respect the animals and have commitments and really commit themselves to physical work.
Right. And Lydia went not only there, but she went to Oklahoma, famous for its barbecue, really did it.
Yeah, Oklahoma. Of course, you know, I'd never been to Oklahoma. And, you know, I heard the play. I remember when I was in Oklahoma where the wind blows.
Right.
And I was so happy. You know what? The wind does blow there.
Yes.
But Oklahoma is very interesting, yes, because of the barbecue, but because of the I went to visit the American soldiers, let's see, they were called, oh gee whiz,
what, in Oklahoma?
Yes, in Oklahoma they were called the African American troops.
Right.
During Civil War.
They were the Buffalo Soldiers.
Exactly. During Civil War, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation was pronounced, and so there was a lot of young Afro-American that became free and whatever and wanted to join the army. But, you know, segregation was still difficult, so they created this new kind of frontier troops of African-American soldiers called the Buffalo Soldiers. So I went to it was the Sill Fort. It's still there, the fort. And, you know, the association of this Buffalo Soldiers is still very existent and very known. And it was wonderful to visit with some of the members of this Buffalo Soldiers that, you know, carried down the tradition. And we cooked out on the prairie with them.
Wow.
They taught me how they live. It was really nice. And, you know, it was amazing. I said, you know, after all these years, you still keep the message. You know, why? What is it? He says, well, it's great. You know, we are very proud as Afro-Americans that we were part of the American kind of independence fight. And that we share this with our next generations, with the children, the Afro-American children coming, so that they would be proud of their ancestors.
Wow.
So that was really wonderful.
I bet. I'm talking to Lydia Bastianich, who you see all the time on her television show, written so many best-selling cookbooks, has so many restaurants for Lydia, Becco, Esca, Del Posto, and restaurants all over the country. Of course, they own Eataly, too, which is everyone's favorite Italian food and wine marketplace. And Eataly has expanded as we speak, and she does a lot of special productions and broadcasts. So usually when you do these specials, Lydia Celebrates America, a Heartland Holiday Feast, where did you end up with the meal that everyone gathered for?
Well, I went back to Pennsylvania, you know, and not too far from Sunbury. We found this beautiful setting. Really rural, and you know, I made a meal for them. I made a meal of everything that they shared along the way with me, in their way. You know, whether it was the shoofly pie, or whether it was the cod fritters, the fritters up. You know, I went all the way up to
In Louisiana?
No, all the way up in the cold country, up in Wisconsin. And we went fishing. We went fishing, eel pout fishing. And they do, you know, it's like frozen, the ice, the lake fishing.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a Scandinavian kind of, you know, years, generations ago. These are Americans, but still they keep. So we went ice fishing for this eel pout, and then we kind of the fritters that they fry, and they make this this little bread kind of pancakes with jam. And so I took all of these foods that they shared with me, and I made a meal, making my kind of food, you know, for the rice. I made a risotto, a great risotto. I made, the Hmong. We went to visit also the Hmong community, which is a Chinese refugees that crossed over.
Where are they now?
Well, they are in the middle of let's see. I'll get you the town. In a minute.
That's all right. What is their food culture?
Their food is they maintain their food as Hmongs, you know. So they went from China, escaped into Vietnam, through camps, ultimately came to America, and in Warsaw, Wisconsin. That's where they have their community. They settled there. They were invited. Some family was invited. Ultimately,
and then they're all there.
They're all there. It was wonderful because a local principal of school kind of accepted the kids, got them into school, and you know what else he did? He had a lot of land. So he lets the Hmong community work the land and grow their vegetables. And you know how important, for the Italians is? And so there they made a pork dish with this mustard green. So I made also a roasted pork, and I made the braised broccoli di rapa, which is
delicious.
Close. So I made this big meal that everyone shared with the products that kind of done my way.
Lydia, it sounds so good. I only wish I could have been with you, hiding in the back, taking it all in. Lydia celebrates America.
But you know what? Now we share it on the special.
I know.
All
I
of America.
Love that. And you have to check PBS to see what it's on in your market, but it's there. And you can just go to PBS.org. You'll find out. Go to PBS.org/Lydia celebrates America. There are recipes. There are stories, and you can see this fabulous series, A Heartland Holiday Feast. Happy holidays, Lydia, to you and yours. We'll talk soon.
Happy holiday, Joan, and to all of your listeners. Happy holidays.
Thank you, Lydia. We'll talk. Ciao. I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC.
New York culture with real New Yorkers. Joan Hamburg, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
You know, I just read a really interesting book called A Drinkable Feast, A Cocktail Companion to 1920s Paris. And when the book came in, it was like, well, do I really want to read this? I had the best time. It takes you back to an era that was so unique, so special. And, of course, Paris, whether it was 1920 or 2018, almost 19, no matter what, is magical. And Philip Green, who's the author of To Have and Have Another, and who had John Hemingway actually write the foreword to this book, is a master. He's a cocktail historian. He's a writer. He's one of the founders of the Museum of the American Cocktail, which you will find in New Orleans. He lectures all over the place. And this book is an adventure in another time when they grew up to become major writers, painters, artists of every kind, where women played a major role in the cultural scene, where bartenders were heroes. Philip Green takes you back to a time that was very unique. And of course, we could not drink. We had prohibition in that time in our country. So Americans just love to go to Paris. And Philip, I'm curious, you're an attorney, you have so many different credits. How did beautiful drinks and all that history get involved in your life?
Thank you for your kind words. And if I need a publicist, I'd like you to be on the short list.
Yeah.
But, thank you. It's long story short, I went to law school in New Orleans. I was a history major in college. I went to Loyola University in New Orleans. And that's a town where if you like to eat and drink and you like history and you like folklore, it just gets into your blood. And then I did my family tree and discovered that a fellow named Antoine Amédée Peychaud, who was the creator of Peychaud's Bitters, which are used in the Sazerac and a bunch of other drinks, he's my cousin. He was the cousin of my great-great-grandmother, Marie-Louise Peychaud. So I sort of was, you know, to the manor born sort of a thing. I've managed to parlay this obscure, you know, relative into a sideline that I love. I love my day job at the Pentagon, but I've been able to write books and speak and what have you, found museums about cocktail history, and I think drinks taste better when you know the backstory. Even if it's bogus, it's still more fun.
No, of course it is. And we, like so many people, Americans, we just love Paris.
Oh,
and
yeah. There's
something about going to the bar at the Ritz Hotel. I'm not telling all of you to stay there at $2,000 a night for not even a large room often, but to sit at that bar where history is all around you, even though it's been renovated not long ago, is still absolutely magical. And your Paris, your description of Paris in the 20s is absolutely unique.
Oh, thank you. That's the cool thing, is so many of these places are still there. And some of them have been renovated, as you say. The Hemingway Bar used to be the ladies' bar at the Ritz. And the Café du Dôme has been renovated. But Harry's New York Bar is almost like a time capsule. That's still there. The sidewalk is still the sidewalk at a lot of these various cafes, the Café de la Paix next to the opera. It's just, my book is sort of a walking tour in some respects, but also a time machine to that era.
And, of course, drinks, they had all kinds of drinks. You know, they weren't just shooting down shots of vodka
or
whiskey.
Well, the Russians were.
The
Russians fleeing the revolution. But, no, you had sort of cross-pollination between the Parisians were used to their aperitifs and their wines and their local beers and their liqueurs. You know, the Americans were coming in, and they wanted an American bar. They wanted, damn it, I want a Manhattan. I want a martini. So you had the best of both worlds. So Americans who stayed and lived there decided to do as the Romans do, and the Parisians were also getting influenced by the American style of cocktail.
Now, cocktails, of course, a very special time in 1920s Paris. But I've noticed that even here in New York, people are asking for what we used to consider old-fashioned Manhattans. And, of course, martinis never went out. But a lot of the drinks that were big at that time are rearing up again.
Yeah, we're in the midst of a cocktail revolution, thanks to Dale DeGroff and a number of other great bartenders, you know, beginning in the 80s and 90s. But it really took off in the early 2000s with the great bar scenes, you know, in New York City. Notably, you know, Milk and Honey, Death and Company, Employees Only, PDT, Please Don't Tell. And the great new bars are opening all the time. You know, Attaboy took the place of Milk and Honey, and of course the Dead Rabbit and Blacktail. Mm-hmm. It's a great time to be an elbow bender in New York and all over the country.
Right, and just like chefs have become celebrities in the last decade, in the 20s, bartenders were heroes in places like Paris. You talk about a guy called Jimmy, I think his name, I don't have...
Charters.
Oh, Charters.
Yeah.
And what a life he had, and how all these writers and painters and socialites would follow him wherever he went.
Yeah, he was quite a magnet, and, you know, he worked at the Dingo. He was behind the bar when Hemingway first met Fitzgerald in 1925. He would go to a bar called the Falstaff, or he, you know, wherever he went, he had his following. and you had bartenders like Frank Meyer at the Paris Ritz. You had Harry McElhone and Bob Card and a fella named Chips at Harry's New York Bar. Yeah, they were rock stars back in the day. And if you crossed the channel to London, you had Harry Craddock behind the stick at the Savoy. Yeah, it's kind of like today's celebrity chefs. And that had been in place since the 1880s, really, from in the U.S. In the Gilded Age, some of these great bartenders were household names.
Right, and describe, I think it was under Jimmy Charters, the night Josephine Baker walked into the bar he was working at, the Jockey, I think, at that time.
Could be, yeah. And Hemingway tells the story, of course, you always have to take his stories with a grain of salt, but Hemingway tells the story of how Josephine Baker came into the Jockey, and he spent the night dancing with her, and then she revealed, literally and figuratively, by the end of the night, that all she was wearing was a fur coat. But he was in a romance with Pauline and, trying to divorce his first wife, Hadley, and he wasn't interested in getting into another relationship with Josephine, but they spent the whole night drinking champagne in her flat, talking about matters of the heart. So, great story.
It's a great story, and it was also a great story because it was fairly warm at the time, and she came in wearing a big fur coat, which everyone noticed. Paris, at that time, too, everyone could go there, and if you were an African-American, you were accepted. You didn't have to deal with things that were going on in America.
Exactly. Yeah, there was so much equality there, from the women, from Natalie Clifford Barney's salon to Gertrude Stein's salon to Sylvia Beach publishing Ulysses. Women were empowered and doing things. You had African Americans who were, they could only play in Harlem and East St. Louis or New Orleans domestically to all black crowds. Well, no, they could come to Paris and play for, an eclectic audience and have a white girlfriend, and nobody would give a damn. They were so far ahead of us in these sorts of things. We had a lot to learn. Still do.
Well, and we still do. And the salons that women like Gertrude Stein had,
right?
Well, to this day, they're the stuff of which Levin's legends are made.
Yeah, not just for collecting people, but for collecting amazing works of art. I mean, she had original Picassos. And, the great story about how Picasso painted her portrait, and she said, "It doesn't look like me," and Picasso says, "It will."
And it did.
And it did.
Which is fine. So I'm talking to Philip Green, whose new book, A Drinkable Feast, is not only full of wonderful history of the 1920s and all the great writers and painters who made it happen, but all the different drinks that were legendary and that are still being resurrected over the years. So of all the drinks that were such stars then, what do you see in American bars and homes? What are the hot drinks?
I see a lot of European influence in what we're drinking today, from aperitif bitters to Amaro to vermouth. We've had this amazing renaissance in vermouth, which of course was originally from Italy and then from France. So we're going back to a lot of the great, the quinine based liqueurs and spirits, absinthe. So we're replicating a lot of what Americans were, tasting in the 1920s, and it's really cool.
Right. What's your favorite drink?
From this book, I've got a couple of discoveries that I really like. One is called the Pierre Loving's Pet Punch. It's sort of like a Manhattan, but it's lighter alcohol. It's sweet vermouth, a bitter aperitif like Campari, a little bit of port, a little bit of rum, and grenadine, which you can actually do without. It's a delightful drink. And then there's another one called the Martinican or Martinican vermouth cocktail. It's Martinique rum, sweet vermouth, Angostura bitters, orange curacao, creme de noyau, and pineapple syrup, and it's delightful. It's like a tiki drink 20 years before there was such a thing.
Now, would those be what you would serve as your holiday drink?
I think the latter, yeah. I mean, with the pineapple, I think it would serve as a nice base to spice it up a little bit. And the Pierre Loving's Pet Punch would also be a good option. Or you could just do something simple like the champagne cocktail and, garnish it with a a little bit of like a dusting of nutmeg or something like that.
Well, that sounds good. But is that good with champagne?
I think it would work, or maybe a pine sprig or something like that, just for accent.
You know, for many years, we had a restaurateur and a really fascinating guy whose story was that he was Josephine Baker's adopted son.
Hmm.
And he loved his drinks, his cocktails, and he would always send, if you were friends of his or the house, incredible champagne. But it just shows you how ignorant I am when it comes to that. Who knew that champagne turns to something not good if you don't use it within a certain period of time?
Of course. Yeah,
I didn't know that you can't really, like fruitcakes, you can't keep that champagne forever.
Well, the fruitcake can always be a doorstop.
Yes, which it is. But champagne will go, right?
Oh, yeah. My in-laws bought a charity basket of champagne, and they put it away for a special occasion.
Right, I did the same thing.
New Year's Eve, we popped open a bottle of Veuve Clicquot, and it was flat, and it was probably a $100 bottle, and it was quite a shame.
Yeah, so, I know.
Shame,
well,
champagne.
Life's lessons. Thank you, Philip Green. Happy holidays
Thank
to you.
Happy holidays.
A drinkable feast, which is not only a cocktail companion to Paris, the magic of Paris in the 1920s, but to all the people who inhabited it and what life was like in those days. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm Joan Hamburg, and you're listening to WABC. All right, everyone, welcome to the holiday edition of the Joan Hamburg Show. And we have a star-studded lineup. And what would holidays be without the Rockettes, without the Christmas Spectacular, which many of us have been going to since we were children. And I know you're going to be fascinated to hear the story of Rockettes. You see these amazing dancers and performers. It is so hard. And people audition time after time to get in. And then they work so hard. I would love it, because what a diet that would be. It's fantastic. And with us now, from our own backyard, is Ellen Mihalik from Randolph, New Jersey. You've been a Rockette for 5 years.
Yes, thank you.
And Samantha Harvey from Maryland, and has worked for 9 seasons.
Hello.
And in their gorgeous wardrobes. So I think people are going to love to hear your story. Let's start with you, Sam. You knew you wanted to dance. You grew up like that.
Well, actually, when I was in the womb, my mom was a dancer, and she was never able to perform professionally. So she loved the Rockettes. So I was dancing around in her womb, swimming around, and I took my first steps in the dance studio. And when I was in second grade, I decided I did not want to dance. I wanted to play soccer. My mom said, I can't have this. So she took me to see the Radio City Christmas Spectacular. I saw the Rockettes, and I fell in love. And here I am. Many years later, and I am so lucky and blessed to be part of this tradition.
So explain, the audition process is hard. Hundreds and hundreds of women from all over the world, and you have to fit the height.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, so at my audition, there were over 500, maybe 600 girls. I came up from Baltimore. I stood in line, wrapped around Radio City, and it was a two-day process, very, very long. You have to be over 18 and proficient in jazz, tap, ballet, and 2 days of auditioning, and a month later, I found out that I was hired. I was very excited moving up to New York with my grandma on the street with the U-Haul, my mom in my empty apartment. I got the phone call, and the rest is history.
And what is your story, Ellen? You grew up in our own backyard.
I sure did. I grew up in New Jersey. I've been dancing my entire life. My older sister was a dancer. I tried all the sports, every activity, always ended up back in the dance studio. And it was always a holiday tradition for my family and I to come see the Rockettes at Radio City. I actually have a picture of myself when I was 4 years old, standing outside under the marquee. And here I am 5 years later, just living the dream, and I get to dance as part of that legacy.
And did you get into after the first audition?
I did. So you have to be at least 18 to audition. However, we have the Rockette Summer Intensive, which I danced in for 3 years.
Explain what that is.
Right, so that's a summer dance intensive for aspiring Rockettes, and it's the only place that you can get our precision technique. You live the life of a Rockette for a week during the summer. So I did that for 3 years before I was even old enough to audition, and then when I was 18, I was blessed with my job.
But you guys work all the time. I mean,
yes.
How many shows a day?
We do 2 to 4 shows a day, and we rehearse.
Imagine, 4 shows a day.
It's incredible. We do up to 16 shows a week, and just compared to a Broadway week, they do about 8 shows. So we are...
And they complain.
We are working hard. Our rehearsals are Monday through Saturday, 10 to 5, so it's a full-time rehearsal schedule. Once we get into the hall, we rehearse 1 to 10, 6 days a week, and then we get into shows. We want to bring you the most spectacular, beautiful show.
And, you know, it used to be that you worked for the season, you know, and mm-hmm. then it was over for a while. Now, no, right? Most of you teach, go on the road.
Absolutely. We are here at Radio City through January 1st in the Christmas Spectacular, but year-round you can find us. We teach a lot of Rockette dance classes. We've performed on the Tony Awards, at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parades, the 4th of July fireworks, at so many different events. So it's so cool to carry this year-round. A lot of us are fitness instructors, but also some of us, we have a lot of moms in the line. We have an accountant. So it's really special to see all these unique individuals, yet we come together to create this line of precision dancing year-round.
How do you, Sam, have time for a life?
We're when really good at time management.
Time, can you?
Absolutely. I think that we like to take moments to pause and find the gratitude in the busyness of our schedule and really be in the present moment, because it is such a gift and such an honor to be part of this amazing legacy.
Well, it's great. And if you haven't been to the Christmas Spectacular, which I'm sure everyone has, this year in particular... Mm-hmm. It's got this huge digital component.
Absolutely.
The
yes.
lights, and it's spectacular.
Yeah, we have so many traditional numbers in the show. We have our Parade of the Wooden Soldiers and the Living Nativity that have not changed since 1933. But this year is definitely the year to come check us out. We have a brand new finale. We have 100 drones dancing above our head. We have brand new Rockette costumes and choreography. It's never before been seen, been done. It's something so special, and it's really just bringing together all of this tradition and all of this innovation for a one-of-a-kind, huge grand finale number.
It's worth seeing.
Absolutely.
Go over after you leave us. And Ellen Mihalik, Samantha Harvey, go have your pictures taken with them later. They do everything. Thank you, guys. We love that.
Thank
you're
here. Thank you very much.
One of the best things. I really appreciate your coming. We've got Ben Stiller coming up. We've got Joy Behar, 20 years on The View. No politics with Joy today, just fun and games. And also, I want to thank our friends at Carnegie Hall. Thank you for sponsoring our holiday event. We absolutely love it. And holiday favorites, December 21st and 22nd. Please buy tickets at carnegiehall.org or Carnegie Charge, 212-247-7800. Welcome to the Joan Hamburg Show.